Welcome back, everyone.
Hi.
Yeah, you. You saying something, you?
What did you say?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes. I'm just testing my video.
Okay. So just a reminder, homework one is going to be due before class Friday, uploaded to Canvas. Hopefully you've gone ahead and got started on that. The first one is predominantly review. If you remember everything, should be real easy and real quick. More likely, it'll take a little bit of time to go back and look at some fundamental circuit analysis techniques. And then the last problem is a little bit of review for a 480 from 481, and a little bit of just giving a sample of kind of how homework problems would look more often than not in this class. A little bit of a design flair to it. Right? Analyze the circuit, but also think about from this analysis how you would go about designing this thing. Any questions on the homework? Okay. Good. One thing I've neglected to say, seems like you all have already heard this, but just for the in-class students, you need to stay in the same seat always for the whole semester. Since there's four of you, just noted where you are for a seating chart. Didn't have to sign up or anything, but make sure you come back to the same seat all semester. It's a better and more varied masks than me. Even if the masks with some more flair. Any other comments or questions before we dive in?
Yeah. I think there are questions in the hand.
Okay.
So, the problem with the building part, manipulate the expression of the two standard form. What is standard form?
Standard form would be for, in this case, a second order polynomial in the denominator. F over Q over omega naught plus one. So essentially get a one in the zeroth order coefficient of S. And then your coefficients on S to the 1 and S to the 2 should give you omega naught and Q for the system.
Okay,
if you have any single poles, be 0 in the numerator. S over something plus 1. The reason to manipulate it in this form is because then those coefficients have specific and defined meaning. This is the break point of that zero, the resonant frequency, Q is the peaking on the body plot.
The denominator of the first order term,
You know, I might have this one wrong. I'd have to go back and look exactly. It might be S times Q over omega naught, but the two should be inverse to one another. It might be in the numerator. In fact, that'll be listed in the fundamentals of power electronics book. Offhand. I'm going to do that explicitly later. Any questions? Okay, not back at where we were. We were working on this boost converter example design. We made some progress last class by replacing this PN diode with a Schottky diode on it by eliminating reverse recovery, going from a minority carrier to a majority carrier device. We could get a pretty sizable increase in efficiency, 2% jump from 94 to almost 96. A cause of that was eliminating the switching losses associated with removing the minority carriers. Going over the Shaki dial, we no longer have minority carriers, so we get rid of that. But found that there were still some switching losses left, so we talked a little bit about where those might come from. And I discussed two distinct mechanisms, and we'll go into these in a lot more detail in the coming lectures. First is just from the static MOSFET transfer characteristic, IDS versus VDS. See that, hey, we've got really two extreme ends of this curve that we want to operate on. We call this thing a switch. And a lot of the ideal switch mode converter approximations say, okay, if it's more or less an open and more or less a short, then it should be nearly lossless. What those don't mention is, how do you get between being an open and a short? We look at the behavior of MOSFET in any sort of circuit environment, in any sort of converter. The operation of the overall converter will dictate how we move in between the off state and the on state. If that goes up through this high loss region, we're going to end up with high instantaneous loss in the channel of the transistor during the switching action. Okay. That would be true whether or not we had any energy storage in the transistor itself. Fortunately, we do have energy storage in these parasitic capacitances, and those are going to cause, not managed properly, some additional loss. Okay. So here separately, even if we don't worry about this and say the transistor just turns on instantaneously, goes from an open to a short, if we have any energy stored in CDS, when we turn that on, we're going to short it out and lose all that energy and have additional switching energy loss associated with these parasitic capacitors. Also, related to the former, the fact that we do have CGS, CGD capacitances on the gate means that we're not going to be able to turn it on instantaneously. It requires some non-zero amount of charge supplied from the gate drive circuit to get that fed to go from cut off to fully on. It means it's going to take some amount of time unless we have infinite current to do this. So we looked a little bit at the switching waveforms in our boost converter, kind of sketching more or less ideal waveforms, considering the effect of the CDS capacitance, but neglecting everything else, saying that we can't let this MOSFET switch instantaneously. All we care about is this CDS capacitance. We found that during the turn on of the MOSFET in our original design, currents in this turn on looks pretty good when we look at the simulation. Turn on the MOSFET, it kind of jumps from zero up to the inductor current. But we saw that there was a bunch of energy going into the FET during its turn off. It never comes back out. That energy is lost here because we short out this CDS when we turn on the device and dissipate all this energy. Sketch here, if we could measure this I channel current, the actual current in the MOSFET separate from its own capacitance. Capacitance is actually inside the MOSFET itself, so we can never really measure this. But if we could, we'd see it overshooting and dropping back down as we dissipate all this energy from the CDS capacitance internal to the channel. And then where we ended was, we talked about, well, during the turn-off transitions, I was left with kind of a resonant circuit between the inductor and the drain to source capacitance. And the inductor, because its current was flowing left to right, charge that CDS capacitance in a resonant manner, which is ideally lossless, neglecting parasitic resistances and other things, small loss elements. That's what got our VDS up to Vout, stored the energy in that capacitance in a lossless manner. If we could do something like that to get it back out, we get it back out in a lossless manner instead of dissipating it. In this brief argument, what if I just let the current ripple be way larger, such that before I try to turn the FET on, the instantaneous inductor current goes negative. We still need the average to be 4 amps because we still want the same output power. But at this point, the current goes negative. As soon as it reverses direction, it is now flowing out of the switch node right to left. The high side diode shuts off because its current has reversed direction. And now this inductor resonates with the CDS capacitance in a way that's going to pull energy out of it. If we time everything perfectly and design it perfectly, we can employ this resonance to move our switch node voltage down to zero and turn on the MOSFET right when it hits zero. We do that, voltage across the MOSFET drain to source is zero, and when we turn it on and short it out, there's no energy in that capacitance, no energy loss. This is a mechanism used very widely in high efficiency and high switching frequency converters called zero volt switching. You turn on the MOSFET when there's already zero volt across it. One of the main targets of that is recovering that CDS energy, that that doesn't end up as loss, energy loss every time you turn the MOSFET on. Okay, so let's try it out and see if it works. So go back to our simulation, and what I'm going to do with some additional insight behind the scenes is drop the inductance down about 5x here. If I drop the inductance down, it's going to give me higher current ripple. I had about an amp of delta IL, drop the inductance down 5x, it should end up with somewhere on the order of 5 times as much current ripple. I got 4 amps average and a little less than 5 amps of current ripple. Delta IL is greater than IL. I should have ripple that causes my inductor current to go negative, at least for a little bit. And let's see, I get another about 2.5% efficiency increase by doing this, by running with much higher current ripple. And at least initially, seems like a win-win. So I get about 2.4% efficiency increase. And my inductor's smaller. Now, actual implementation of inductors comes down to some details, but general trend, smaller inductance with comparable resistance, I should be able to implement that in a smaller physical size. Now my converter got more efficient and more powerful. We'll see, nothing in power electronics is ever a win-win. Maybe some more complication to it. I've got to figure out exactly how to size it and how to switch everything to make this work. But for the moment, let ourselves dream and look at how this operates. Right. So here's my waveforms now. Again, diode current and MOSFET current up top, output voltage, switch node voltage, inductor current in the middle, then input and output power on the bottom. And first kind of things we see looking at these currents, I have a whole lot more ripple. So that hit me on, now I have a much higher peak current, somewhere on the order of 9 amps. But what it gets me is my inductor current goes below zero right at this time when I'm about to turn on the MOSFET. Okay. Here. IL of T is less than zero. My average is still 4 amps. Okay. So see, first we got what we're trying to do. So you can kind of already see, and we'll zoom in a second. But this inductor current goes below zero. That causes the switch node voltage to start falling, the diode to shut off as soon as its current hits zero. See this red curve here, it drops, hits zero, and stays at zero. The current from the inductor ends up going through the MOSFET after it crosses zero. And that negative current down through the MOSFET is going through the drain source capacitance and dropping the switch node voltage. You can already see a little bit that the slew rate of this signal is much lower than in the previous simulations where we were switching it on, switching it off, and we had near vertical lines. We even compare it to this one. Here we're getting the same type of resonant behavior, but at 9 amps instead of minus 0.5 amps. This line is no longer a steep vertical line. Zoom in on it, it's a slower resonant transition, bringing the voltage all the way down to zero. Okay. Looking at the impact of running with this smaller inductance, we have this much higher ripple. For the same average and same waveform, a higher ripple means a higher RMS. So we will have slightly higher conduction losses everywhere for the same average current. And if I have 4 amps average and 0 ripple, then 4 amps DC is the average, is the peak, is the RMS. For the same average, higher peak means higher RMS. See? And with a triangle wave like this, 100% ripple, we can go up to something like a 1/√3 type increase in it. Okay, but that does mean my conduction losses will increase a little bit. We'll see in the next couple iterations of the circuit trying different things. The design of the circuit is a little bit absurd because everything is such small resistances that conduction losses don't matter. With a 48 ohm output resistance having 2 milliohms here and 5 milliohms here, these conduction losses are more or less nothing. So I can get away with it in this example. More generally, that could hurt me. It means I'm reducing switching losses, but I am somewhat increasing conduction losses. So let's look at the individual switching actions. The turn off, very similar to what we've seen before. The turn off was always at this peak current. Now it's 9 amps instead of about 5 amps, so it goes a little bit faster, but the waveforms look pretty similar. FET turns off here, is where the gate signal drops. Some delay time for it to actually turn off, so it turns off relatively quickly. And then what we see is this really high current charging that drain to source capacitance, causing the switch node voltage to rise up. This high current comes down, charges the switch node. It is a resonant circuit, but the current stays pretty constant the whole time. So we have kind of a nearly constant slope here of about 9 amps over CDS charging it up. So I look at the actual energy going into the MOSFET during that transition. I see again this 1.33 microjoules here. That energy is from the inductor current charging up CDS. And that energy at the end of this transition is sitting in CDS. CDS is still at 48 volts. That 1.3 microjoules is 1/2 CDS 48 volts squared, the energy in that capacitor. The real difference comes at the turn on, where now we have a much different waveform than before. Okay, so this thing, it works. You see, looking at the instantaneous power on the MOSFET through this transition, it is minus 1.03 microjoules. It means I put 1.33 microjoules in during the turn off transition. To turn on, I get 1.03 back out. That is, as the inductor current resonates with this capacitance. See, it's going through the diode at the beginning of the transition. This red curve is the diode current. It hits zero. Then the inductor current begins going through CDS. And during this transition, energy is transferred from CDS to the inductor. It's going more negative current, but the energy in the inductor, 1/2 Li squared, goes up with the amplitude of its current. Energy is initially in CDS. As its voltage drops, it's supplying energy back to the circuit and it's going into the inductor, increasing its negative current. Okay. Somewhere, we then actually turn on the MOSFET. When we do so, its voltage is very nearly zero. Actually, a little late in this simulation. Would have been a little better to turn it on about here. Because I'm a little bit late, voltage has already gone down to zero. Gone a little bit past it, and turned on the body diode of the MOSFETs, kind of trying to keep going, resonate and go negative, but the body diode of the MOSFET will prevent negative drain to source voltage greater than whatever that 4 volt is, a volt or two. So I've got a little bit of additional loss still in the circuit because I turn on that body diode. I kept playing with the simulation and move this back by some 10 nanoseconds. I might have gotten a slightly higher efficiency. Not super appreciable though. See the very slightest of spike here when it turns back on, and that's just from the process of going from a forward voltage across the device to more or less 0 volts across it. 1 volt down to 10 millivolts or so. And get most of my energy back. Okay. So I take these two together, got 300 nanojoules of energy that's lost in these two transitions, because this one microjoule I put in, I get back. Majority of it is sloshing back and forth between the inductor and capacitor. Only a small amount of it is lost.
Do you really think that little spike was?
Yeah, this little spike just comes out of shorting out this small amount of voltage here. Mm-hmm. So during this time, I really have, never give it a name, the FET body diode. On. And so there is actually a little bit of energy in that capacitance because it's got, maybe I haven't looked back at what the forward voltage of that diode is, say it's 1 volt. We've got a little bit of energy in that capacitor. It's charged to 1 volt in the negative direction. It's like a different capacitance, but same idea. And when I turn this channel on, I am still shorting that out and causing a small transient, small jump in DVDT. So I get a little bit of energy loss right there. See, kind of compared to the 1 microjoule area, this thing is negligible. It's almost nothing. But there is a little bit of a transient there. Okay. Comments, questions, make sense? Okay, so everything's great. All I had to do was just use a smaller inductor, which I'd like to do anyway, and I got a significantly higher efficiency out of the system. Are there problems with it? Well, more nuance that I may be leading to. First, let's try one other thing. I can actually start running this thing at much higher switching frequency now that my switching losses are so low. So here I pumped it up to 1 megahertz. Typically avoid higher switching frequencies because we've got switching losses and they get higher with switching frequency. Got kind of a fixed energy for every switching action. So as my switching frequency goes up, my losses will go up proportionally. Here, since I've removed almost all of those switching losses, I can start going to higher frequency. Here, pumped up by 5x from 202 kilohertz to 1 megahertz. See, I had to change around the inductance here. I think L goes to 710 nanohenries, even smaller. But tuning it, getting the correct inductance to make my ripple as large as I need, I can keep these nice soft switching behaviors. The zoom in on the turn on of the MOSFET. Again, current goes negative, nice resonant transition down to 0 volts, and the MOSFET turns on when all that energy has already been extracted from the capacitor. Scaling up in frequency, see again, my peak current went up a little bit though. Here now we're up at 11 amps peak. And fired some analysis and some tuning to figure out that 710 nanohenries was the right inductance. The basic idea here is I've got some amount of energy that got stored in the capacitance. If I want to pull that all out, put all that energy in the inductor, as the inductance drops, to get that same amount of energy, I'm going to need higher current, which means my current goes more negative with this smaller inductance. means it has to go more positive to keep the same average. My ripple goes up even a little bit more. And this is all stuff that we'll talk about and analyze in detail in coming lectures. Now just kind of discussing at a high level. Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, yes and no. And we'll talk at the end of this introductory example about some of the limitations. Practically at a megahertz, we can do this. I'll actually show an example of that. Megahertz is about the right point, but we can't do this ad nauseum. If I started saying, hey, drop it, but the inductance by another factor of 10, let's operate at 10 megahertz. There are a number of different mechanisms that are going to come into play to make this harder. Okay. So we'll discuss that in a moment. Everything is not so peachy keen. It's not so simple. There are other things that will come into play. And this simulation is absolutely overly ideal. We'll see that definitively in a moment. Reference to the specific one you said, inductor interwinding capacitance can be significant, but in this case probably is pretty doable. One, we've got such a small inductance, 710 nanohenries, that maybe just a couple of turns around a small ferrite bead. And then two, specifically that capacitance, I've really in these only been talking about CDS. But in fact, when we go to analyze it, what I really care about is what's the capacitance between this node and any DC node. So this C winding capacitance of the inductor is really effectively in parallel with CDS. Actually not going to change anything. It'll just make CDS look larger. Reason being, CDS goes between the switch node and ground, some DC node. C winding goes between the switch node and VG, some other DC node. So they'll be biased VG away from each other, but a constant DC VG away from each other. And any AC waveforms on them are going to be exactly the same. Same reason why we've mentioned diode capacitance. But I've really just been talking about CDS. Well, as long as our output capacitance is large so that Vout stays constant in that 10 nanosecond switching transition, all three of these are really effectively in parallel with one another when we analyze this. Again, something we'll discuss in more detail coming up. But to simplify, I'm really just talking about this capacitance, but any of these are actually part of that. But overall, yes, there are some significant limitations we're talking about. First one, even before we consider any more complex models of the circuit, that everything here is set up and fairly finely solved and tuned to get this perfect operation, where exactly at the time I let the inductor current drop to zero, it resonates for just long enough to get my switch node voltage to go to zero, and then at that point I turn on the MOSFET. If I were to keep this exact hardware design and say, now let's operate at some different power, continue regulating the voltage, what I'd like to do is adjust the duty cycle, this boost converter, right? I drop the power, I may want to drop this duty cycle, which means my inductor current is going to decrease and it's going to drop down to zero earlier in the period. And what I want is to have exactly, you know, the FET on, then a resonant transition, then the diode on, then the resonant transition to get this zero voltage switching, and then as soon as I get it, turn the MOSFET on. If I have to start changing duty cycle, those times aren't going to line up perfectly anymore. So I get something like this. Significantly worse. This is at an output power of 1 watt with a constant switching frequency. Efficiency is like 68%. Down at 1 watt, may not care so much about efficiency anymore, because even if I lose 32%, that's still 320 milliwatts. It's probably not going to change my cooling design or anything. It's not a lot of energy, but it indicates there's a problem. Perhaps the bigger problem is all the EMI that's going to be generated from all of this ringing happening. So problem here is I've gone deep into DCM. This interval is where my FET's on. This interval here is where my diode's on. And then all of this, which should be my D3 kind of interval, neither FET nor diode on. What happens is because I've got this small inductance resonating with the capacitance, and I don't turn on the MOSFET, it just continues resonating back and forth, energy between the inductance and the capacitance ringing out during this entire interval. No power getting transferred to the output, no power getting really taken from the input, and some AC. Ring back and forth, and then way out here at this time, I actually go and turn the FET back on again. And in this case, just by chance, that happens at the peak of this ring, so I still have a big voltage on the FET, energy stored in that CDS capacitance that's lost.
Dr. Kostnick, what's D3?
Excuse me, you?
What is D3? So
D3?
D3
would be a 481 type nomenclature. It's just the duty cycle of the interval where neither the FET nor the diode is on. So if we have a CCM type converter, we talk about D and D prime, the interval where the FET's on and the interval where the diode's on, the duty cycle of those. When we go into DCM, we now have three intervals. We talk about D1, D2, D3. It's FET on, diode on, and nothing on.
Oh, okay. I see. Yeah.
So this is the D3 interval length would be D3 times TS. Okay, so DCM get me part of the way there, as long as I allow myself to really carefully tune everything, get exactly the right inductance for this behavior, make sure I time my gate drive signals so that the FET turns on exactly at the moment where the switch node voltage hits zero. I can improve things a little bit going to low power if I get rid of an assumption that my switching frequency stays constant. Okay. I can start increasing the switching frequency, try to keep things centered here, but an entire period is just this part of the waveform. Then I can reduce power while still keeping waveforms that kind of look exactly like this, but just get smaller and smaller. Problem there is I'd be going up to 10 or 100 megahertz, and if I want to go all the way to zero power, I'd be up at very high switching frequency to get there. It may require me to start switching way faster than I want to. I'm starting from a megahertz here, not have all that much room to switch a lot faster. One other alternative is to get rid of this diode. The problem here is that once the current hits zero, diode shuts off, and then I've just got to ring out for the rest of the interval. The inductor current can't go negative for very long. Can only go negative for as long as it takes for the inductor to resonate with the capacitor and bring it back. I get rid of this diode and replace it by a switch that can conduct current in both directions. Then I can allow that current to go more negative and change around the operation. So we're going to try here. go to a synchronous implementation, a synchronous boost, where both of my switches are transistors. MOSFETs are current bidirectional. When they're on, they can conduct current either way, drain to source or source to drain. In both cases, as long as the channel is on and we're in a triode type operation, the model of it is an on resistance. Different from an IGBT. IGBT can have current in both directions. If you have an anti-parallel diode, that means current going in the reverse direction has to go through the diode. In a MOSFET, if gate to source voltage is off, current can go through the body diode. But if gate to source voltage is on, it'll go through the channel, still be in on resistance either direction. Okay. So FET is a good current bidirectional device. It is still voltage unidirectional. So it can only block voltage drain to source. You try to put a source to drain voltage, it'll turn on the body diode, whether the FET's on or off. It'll allow me to let the inductor current go negative during the time when it's flowing through this high side device. Okay. This implementation gives me two things. First, I said this is gonna allow negative current. And I'll kind of say controlled negative current. You get a little bit with the diode just during that resonant transition, but it just was what it was. It was one resonant transition of the diode shutting off when the current hit zero. The MOSFET, we can continue that D prime type interval and allow the current to go as negative as we want. And then the other good thing, potentially, depending on the design, is we eliminate the diode forward voltage type loss. And replace it with an R-on type loss. Which for most diode MOSFET pairs for low enough current should be smaller conduction loss. Place with okay. A couple of good things. Drawbacks, maybe more expensive, now requires that I have either two gate drivers or a gate driver that can drive two devices. Simulation got one gate driver driving two devices. And it's gonna require some additional consideration of the modulation waveforms. I had the MOSFET and the diode kind of just does its job. When the FET turns off, the diode turns on. When the FET turns on, the diode turns off. I've got two MOSFETs, I have to control them both individually, and I gotta make darn sure that I don't ever turn on both of these devices at the same time. I look at like the gate drive waveforms of these things. I'm gonna have to insert a dead time, control it very precisely. So versus time, my VGS is, call this VGS1. On, off, on, some second device, plus minus VGS2. And I need to make sure that I have dead times in between them. I'm switching between these devices, I need to turn off the conducting device a little before I turn on the non-conducting device to make sure it gives them each time to switch. With this device, even though my gate driver has commanded it to turn off, we've seen in any number of these waveforms, the gate to source voltage goes low. It's a little bit of time before it's actually shut off. If we want to allow these resonant transitions, it's an even longer time. I have to shut off one device, give the converter time to go through the switching transition I want, and then turn on the other device after. So it's going to require some complexity in terms of how I supply these gate drive waveforms. I'll have to manage, make sure I can implement in my control and modulation circuitry. But we live in a great day where we've got a lot of options in terms of digital control, so probably something you can manage with enough consideration in the mapper. So that's our synchronous converter. Place the dial with the MOSFET. Do some work in terms of the gate drive waveforms, and we get here. Here, I'm back at an output power of 48 watts at full power operation. Here, because I had tuned everything to get this really nice waveform when I had the diode, I switch over to MOSFETs, it's really quite similar. The only difference is you're going to see a little bit more current division between the two MOSFETs. The MOSFET's got a little bit higher capacitance, so we were just talking about both CDS and the diode capacitance are charged. I'm seeing more of that current go from the MOSFET. A little bit of a current spike having to do with turning on that high side MOSFET when the diode would have normally turned on. Because that's up at this high current, IL1, 10 amps, nearly 11 amps. There's a little bit of residual loss there because it's such a fast transition, but it ends up not being a lot of actual energy. Looking at the switching transition, so here I've zoomed out enough so we can see both of them at the same time, the energy go into these capacitances and then come back out of it. Stored in CDS and then recovered. Looking at our switch node voltage, both of these transitions, these nice looking resonant transitions. This first one's a little bit faster because we're up at nearly 10 amps. Our initial condition on the inductor current. Second one a little bit slower, we're down here maybe minus 1 amp. But both of them are resonant transitions between the inductor current and these capacitances. Okay, so it looks like at 48 watts, but here, main advantage of doing this that we talked about is for low power operation. Now this is dropping again down to 1 watt. What I can do in this case, keep more or less similar duty cycles, just regulating the output voltage, but allow the inductor current to go more negative to drop the output power. See here, my average of the inductor current just slightly above 0 amps, 1 watt output, 1/12 of an amp coming at the input. So it's very small. I keep the same, about 12 amps total peak to peak. Keeping nearly the same duty cycle, same switching frequency. Efficiency is now 91%. Pretty darn good at 1 watt output. 90 milliwatts a watt. Okay. The reason I can do that is because here, that stays on. Even after the current goes negative, because it is a current bidirectional device, that high side FET continues conducting until the gate drive waveform draws the turn off. Yes. The table here. Okay. One more design I'm going to discuss, maybe do it very quickly. This is recapping everything we've done up to this point. So we started with this silicon diode at 22 microhenries inductance, 202 kilohertz. Placed it with a Schottky and got some benefit. Then we went to DCM type operation, soft switching by dropping the inductance. Another 2.5% efficiency increase. Then we went to 1 megahertz and saw actually a moderate efficiency decrease. by just switching faster, dropping the inductance even further. Still some residual switching loss that's going up as we go to higher switching frequency, but since we've eliminated most of it, the impact is relatively minimal. Then we replace that Schottky diode with a MOSFET, keeping the 710 nanohenry inductor, switching at 1 megahertz, getting rid of that BF loss. That was really the dominant remaining loss. Just a little bit of switching loss, a little bit of R on and RL conduction loss. Eliminated almost everything. We get up to 99.6% efficiency. Here, I'll note, never be able to build that thing and actually get that efficiency. That is a byproduct of this being a simulation where I've eliminated almost every loss mechanism that's modeled in it. There still are on resistances, but from the original design, they're only, 10 milliohms per device, and I got two in parallel. They're almost nothing relative to the currents in the circuit. 2 milliohms in the inductor, and it's almost nothing. And we've eliminated almost all of the switching losses. Gate drive is ideal, able to drive these things extremely quickly. So there's a lot of things here that you wouldn't be able to actually accomplish in a real circuit. So this, somewhere kind of in this range, this has become completely impractical for an actual piece of hardware. But the mechanisms and what we're talking about, showing the difference in eliminating these mechanisms, is what I'm trying to convey here. Does that make sense? The last one that I'm just going to mention briefly, something we'll spend a fair amount of time on in the course later on, is a resonant implementation of the boost converter. This is what's known as the ZVS quasi-resonant boost. And we'll go into details on these, but what we've been looking at so far are circuits where we're employing this LC resonance just during these switching bedtimes to get nice switching behavior. Generally just call these soft switching converters. This one's called quasi-square wave converters. That's the better one. Switch node voltage looks kind of like a square wave, but because of these resonant transitions, not quite a square wave anymore. Going further into this type of soft switching analysis, we start looking at as quasi-resonant or fully resonant converters. These are converters where either one full switching interval, all of DTS, is fully resonant, or the entire period, everything's fully resonant. Okay. Just taking this idea even further and saying, instead of just having a resonance during the dead time, let's do it during a significant portion of the period. So the ZVS quasi-resonant boost converter looks a lot like a boost converter. What it does is it incorporates two elements into the operation that would normally be parasitics. Different color here. So, back. These two elements are now going to become part of the design, part of the operation of this thing. This capacitance incorporates the drain to source capacitance, the MOSFET. But to actually design this thing, we may intentionally be increasing that capacitance. So here I'm actually adding 10 nanofarads in parallel with the drain to source capacitance of the MOSFET, making that thing that from our whole motivation up till now is a parasitic that I don't like. I'm actually just intentionally making it bigger. And the other one here, LR, would be like the drain to source inductance of the MOSFET or your power loop inductance in your layout. Normally a thing you're trying to minimize. In this design, I added an additional 2.4 microhenries in there. Made that inductance much bigger. If you want to operate this thing as a normal boost converter without consideration of resonant operation, this is a terrible idea. Okay, you're putting a big inductance in series with something that's meant to have a square wave of current, a big capacitance in parallel with something that's meant to have a square wave of voltage. It's going to destroy the traditional waveform. But I'm not going to operate it traditionally. Change switching times around, customize switching frequency. In this case, it fell out at 225 kilohertz to get exactly the waveforms I want. Just as an example here, here is that ZVS quasi-resonant boost converter. Waveforms, as you can see, is kind of diode current. It is fully resonant during the entire time. that the diode is conducting. And then the MOSFET drained to source voltage. Is about a half of the sinusoid resonating the entire time. Okay. What do I get out of this type of operation? A few things that need to be designed into it. Bad ones first. VDS, this peak is going up to about 120 volts. Traditional boost, peak on nothing should be greater than the output voltage. Here, more than three times the output voltage. Three times the output voltage. Okay, I'm getting higher stresses, higher peak VDS stress on the MOSFET, a little bit higher peak current on my diode. What I get out of it though are what we got before. VDS resonates up, comes back down to zero before I turn on diode, before I turn on the FET itself. VDS has already resonated back to zero, so I can get zero voltage switching. It also has some other nice characteristics. Like when I shut off the MOSFET, drain to source voltage doesn't just shoot up the same way it did in our previous implementation. It actually starts resonating and rises much slower. If my gate drive isn't ideal, that gives me more time to get the gate drive all the way down to zero before that voltage gets large. Allows me to have smaller losses in the channel. Same thing with the turn on. When I turn the FET on, voltage is coming back down at a relatively slow rate compared to a square waveform. Gives me some time in here to be a little bit off, but when I actually turn that FET on and still get very low losses out of it. Okay, a little bit over on time. Main conclusion from this, of course, is going to be about analyzing resonant behaviors in power electronics, figuring out how to leverage them into design to improve their behaviors. We'll begin here next time, just talk a little bit about resonant circuits, remind you of some things, nothing that's going to make a difference or help you on the homework, but talk about fundamentally, what happens in a resonant circuit and how is that going to play into power electronics design. Then we'll talk a little bit about limitations and show some examples and then wrap up this introductory series of lectures. Okay. We'll pick up there on Friday. Thanks, everyone.